We're happy to have Gerald Cooper today. We will talk about a long list of aspects of topology and geometry.
Thank you. At times like this, I wish I was bilingual. But I grew up in England, and I did pretty well in high school, except in French. And I've got no ear for foreign languages, but somehow, you know, growing up in England, there's no point in learning French, because that's, you know, it's far, far away. Unfortunately, now I go to France pretty much every year to work with colleagues, and so, you know, the French I didn't learn, I kind of pick up by the time I'm ready to leave. I can order coffee in French, and I come back, I lose it all. Physics, a bit like a foreign language. But I was quite good at physics in high school and as an undergraduate. The thing is, with foreign language, though, I mean, if you don't use it, it kind of goes. And so, you know, I wish I could. I was bilingual like Dave, but I'm not. I'm completely monolingual. So I apologise. This is going to be mathematics without the kind of physics aside. And so what I want to do today is talk about some of the geometry and topology of three manifolds and the kind of Thurston picture. And there are lots of aspects to this, but one I want to kind of convey a bit is the following. So before Thurston came along, one had three manifolds, and these were just objects, a discrete set of objects. And after Thurston, one begins to think there's a kind of continuum. And in this continuum, there are some discrete points, and they're manifolds, but you can kind of move between them through kind of generalized manifolds. And so you're no longer looking at just a discrete set of objects, but in some sense, some kind of continuum. And so that's a kind of new, it kind of gives a unity somehow to the whole subject. So one of the things I want to do is say what that means a bit. And so I'm going to start out by talking a bit about, well, so I want to talk about geometric structures, in particular hyperbolic structures, and deforming them moduli. So it seems wise to start out in dimension two. And so you have to think about, to start with, Euclidean torus. So the quotient of the Euclidean plane, T is the torus, it's the quotient of the Euclidean plane by a group generated by a pair of translations. So you have a pair of vectors in the plane, A and B, and we take the lattice generated by A and B, so integer multiples of A and B, and quotient out the plane by that lattice, and we get some Euclidean torus. And so sitting on that torus, there's a pair of geodesics corresponding to these generators of the lattice. And so this, I'm going to restrict attention to just tori of area 1. And so there are moduli here. And actually, there's two versions of moduli. There's the Teichmuller space. So in the Teichmuller space version of moduli, the parameter space can be thought of as, the set of parameters can be thought of as the points in the hyperbolic plane. But there's the other version of parameter space, moduli space. And here, the parameter space is the modular surface. So that is what you get when you divide out the hyperbolic plane by the integer matrices of determinant 1. So let me just say a bit about this. The naive way of... so you want to classify tori, Euclidean tori, up to geometry, area 1. And the naive way to do that is to ask if two Euclidean tori are isometric. and that leads to the modular surface. And incidentally, that is a kind of well-known two-dimensional orbifold. So it's a hyperbolic orbifold. It's got a cone point of order 2, a cone point of order 3, and a cusp. The other way to do it is uses what's called a marked surface, a marking. And so in this approach, one imagines you have a torus sitting in your hand, maybe this torus, a fixed topological torus, and maybe you mark on it a fixed pair of curves, A and B. And then you think about putting different Euclidean structures on this particular torus. So the point is that in the mark situation, you can distinguish between B being long and A being short, and vice versa. Whereas if you just use the naive approach, ask, are two Euclidean metrics on the torus, two Euclidean tori isometric, well, the isometry might change the marking. So these are the two notions, a kind of Titmuller space notion of moduli, where you mark the surfaces. And this leads to a topologically simple parameter space. Topologically, the parameter space is just the Euclidean plane. But in fact, there's a natural way of measuring the distance between two Euclidean metrics on a torus, something called the Titmuller metric. And with that metric, the moduli space turns out to be the hyperbolic plane. And there are automorphisms of the torus. So automorphisms of the torus, self-maps of the torus, these correspond to invertible integer matrices. So these automorphisms take one point in Titmuller space and move it to another point in Titmuller space. And when you quotient out by that, you get the moduli space. So there's a close relationship between these two things. One, the moduli space is a quotient of the Titmuller space. And the other point that comes out of this discussion is that the automorphisms of the torus transform this parameter space, the Titmuller space, to itself. They act on the Titmuller space, and the quotient is this other space, the moduli space. So, so much for the parameters on the Euclidean torus. Now let's think about the parameter space of hyperbolic, of a higher genus surface. So now we're going to think about hyperbolic surfaces. So we'll think about some closed surface of genus G. So I'm picking genus 2 here, I guess. Oh, actually, well, there's one more thing I wanted to say here, and this is relevant to what's coming up in a moment. One way to analyse the moduli space of the torus is you can, if you have a Euclidean metric on this torus, this curve B is realised by a geodesic. And so you can cut the torus along this geodesic B. And when you cut that way, you get a circular cylinder. And the circular cylinder has got two copies of the geodesic B in it, if you like. And the parameter, well, so there's a parameter here. Actually, the parameter, one parameter is the length of this curve B. Now, we're told that the area of this torus is 1, so I don't have to tell you the height of the annulus, because the height is 1 over the length of B. So that when I cut open along B, I get an annulus of area 1, and that annulus is determined by the length of one of the boundary curves. But then the extra information, there's extra information when you glue back up. When you glue back up, one point, you have to glue the top circle to the bottom circle, and there's a twist that comes in when you do that gluing. You have to, I mean, that twist is going to affect the length of the geodesic A. So the point here is that the parameters consists of a length, and that is the length of B, and that's a non-negative real number, and also a twist angle. And the twist angle, you might think, was between 0 and 2 pi. But in fact, it's any real number. And this is kind of the difference between moduli space and Teichmuller space. If you glue this cylinder with a full twist, then the marking is different. You can distinguish, the curve that goes vertically upwards versus the curve that wraps around once and glues up. So these are the parameters for the Teichmuller space. It's very simple. You can parameterize the Teichmuller space by taking the length of this curve together with a twist parameter when you cross it. So now when you come to a surface of genus 2, the idea is you can cut it up into pairs of pens. So here one takes 2g minus 2 curves. That doesn't seem right. G here is 2. 2 2s are 4. Minus 2. Maybe I should take 3G minus 3 curves. Yeah, that seems to work. Take 3G minus 3 curves and cut this surface along these curves. So again, if you have a hyperbolic metric on this surface, these curves can be realized by geodesics in that hyperbolic metric. And then when you cut, what you get, well, the surface falls apart into two subsurfaces, each one of which is kind of simple. It's what's called a pair of pants. It's called a pair of pants because it's got three boundary components. There's a big one where your waist goes. Well, it doesn't have to be big, of course, and two legs. So this is called a pants decomposition. And so, again, by analogy with the annulus case, it turns out that a pair of pants, so an annulus of area 1 is determined by the length of the boundary curve. And it turns out, with a bit of hyperbolic geometry, that, there are various possibilities for a hyperbolic pair of pants with geodesic boundary curves. But in fact, it's determined by the lengths. So the lengths determine a pair of pants. So we have some parameters for Teichmuller space of the torus coming from the lengths of these curves. And of course, these curves, when we cut open, they appear in pairs. The cutting I've done, the pairing is like this. So to reassemble the surface, you've got to glue. You glue this curve and this curve. Ooh, my labelling's gone wrong. The curve in the middle should have been L2. And maybe I'll make that L1. So when we reassemble, we glue these two curves together. And there's a twist available when you do that. And then you glue this one to this one. That reassembles to give you that. So there are twists every time you glue as well. So it turns out then that the Teichmuller space of a surface of genus G is again parameterized by lengths and twists. You've got one length, which is a non-negative real number, and you've got one twist, which again can be any real number, and you've got one for every curve. So we've got 3g minus 3 curves. So topologically, this is Euclidean space of dimension 6g minus 6. And now, another way to think of this is the Euler characteristic of the surface is 2 minus 2g. So another way to think of this is it's actually Euclidean space of dimension the Euler characteristic times 3. But you can think of 3 as the dimension of the Lie group SL2R. And the point about the Lie group SL2R is that this is basically isometries of the hyperbolic plane. We're talking about hyperbolic structures here. So the dimension of the Lie group of isometries of the hyperbolic plane is relevant. That's dimension 3. So another way to think of this is that the parameter space, its dimension, is the Euler characteristic times the dimension of the relevant Lie group. And another way to think of that is by counting degrees of freedom. I mean, every hyperbolic structure here has corresponds to a holonomy homomorphism from the fundamental group of the surface into this Lie group. And every generator of the surface, of which there are 2G minus of which there are 2G generators, gets mapped to some matrix. You have 3 degrees of freedom. But then you lose 2 degrees of freedom, one coming from conjugacy, which doesn't change hyperbolic structure, and one coming from the fact there is one relation in the fundamental group of the surface. So this is the expected dimension of representations of the fundamental group of the surface into the Lie group. And this expected dimension turns out to be the dimension of the Teichmuller space. Okay, well, again, you can form the moduli space. This is the situation for marked surfaces. And again, every time you have a homeomorphism of this surface to itself, that moves the marking around. It gives you this more naive notion of moduli space. It's a quotient of Teichmuller space by the group of automorphisms of the surface. So I want to think a little bit about what happens as you degenerate a hyperbolic surface, as the structure goes off to infinity. So I'll kind of draw a picture of the kind of thing I have in mind. So this is a degeneration. So I'm thinking about, in this example, a hyperbolic surface of genus 3, and it's becoming very long and skinny. And at one end, there's a kind of punctured, there's a genus 1 bit, and at the other end, there's a genus 2 bit. And what's going on is there's a curve in the middle, which is getting very short. The length here, epsilon, is going to 0. And at the same time, that actually forces the diameter here to go to infinity. So if we kind of draw a picture of Teichmuller space is just here Euclidean space of that dimension. You can imagine a sequence of hyperbolic metrics on this surface, and they're kind of going to infinity in Teichmuller space as the diameter of this surface goes to infinity. And in the limit, so what kind of limit do you get? Well, here there's a notion of the Gromov-Hausdorff limit, and I'll say a bit more about this in a minute. So for the Gromov-Hausdorff limit, you get to pick a base point. So there's 3 obvious choices to pick a base point in this example. You could pick a base point in the kind of genus 1 bit on the left, or the genus 2 bit on the right, or maybe you could pick a base point in the middle. And so correspondingly, there are 3 possible limits here in the kind of Gromov-Hausdorff sense. One limit is it's a genus 1 surface with a puncture, a hyperbolic surface. Another limit, if you take the base point on the right, would be a genus 2 surface, again with a cusp. So these are finite area surfaces, but they're not compact, they have a cusp. And the third possibility, if you take the base point and the limit, you get dimensional collapse. And one gets here the limit being the real line. So here one has a situation where you're changing the metric on a surface. You're going off to infinity, in fact, and something new appears in the limit. And I want to discuss a similar kind of issue in 3 dimensions with hyperbolic manifolds to, well, for the experts to talk about hyperbolic Dane surgery and how you can change the topology of a 3 manifold this kind of way. So here, of course, I mean, here we're starting out with a compact surface of genus 3. with changing the geometry on it and extracting a limit of different topology. And here it's fairly simple what's going on. I mean, one either loses part of the surface or there's some kind of dimensional collapse. In dimension three, something more interesting happens. Let me just, while I'm here, talk about the Teichmuller, the Thurston compactification. So there's something called the Thurston boundary of Teichmuller space, the Thurston compactification. And so Teichmuller space, it's this Euclidean space, it's not compact. And there are several ways of putting a boundary on Teichmuller space, but Thurston's way is very nice. And the idea in Thurston's method is that, well, here we had a sequence. Well, here we had a sequence of structures going off to infinity, corresponding to a simple closed curve on the surface that was pinching. Well, points in the Thurston boundary are basically they're the kind of pinched curve as you go off. But that's not quite true, because another thing you could do. I mean, you could, instead of pinching the same curve, you could, on the nth surface, you could pinch an nth curve. You could keep changing the curve you were pinching. And in the limit, instead of pinching a simple closed curve, you're kind of pinching along an infinitely long simple closed curve. You're actually pinching along the limit of a closed geodesic. You're pinching along what's called a geodesic lamination. So these limiting objects are really geodesic laminations. And the picture actually is as nice as possible. So technically these things are projective measured laminations or projectivized measured laminations or projectivized measured geodesic laminations, whichever you prefer. But anyway, this boundary turns out to be a sphere of the expected dimension. And so this compactified space you get by adding the Thurston boundary turns out to be a closed ball of the expected dimension. The boundary of the ball is the Thurston boundary. Those correspond to generalized geodesic simple closed curves on the boundary, kind of infinitely long geodesic simple closed curves. The points in the interior are honest hyperbolic metrics. Okay. One feature here of hyperbolic surfaces, that if you make one loop get short, the transverse direction gets long. And this is a feature of having banded negative curvature, and it's actually a feature of hyperbolic geometry in all dimensions. This is the Margulis lemma. So the Margulis lemma is a statement about about hyperbolic N-manifolds. There are more general versions. And roughly what it says is that in a hyperbolic N-manifold, in a hyperbolic N-manifold, short geodesics have fat normal bundles. So here, for example, we've got a short geodesic on this surface, and there's a very big normal bundle about it. I mean, you can kind of expand the normal bundle out a long way before it bumps into itself. So there's a fat, in other words, there's a large normal bundle about it. If you measure distance, if you start with the geodesic, and then you start kind of inflating a balloon around the geodesic, you can inflate it a long way until it bumps into itself. And the Margulis lemma is a kind of universal statement about this. It's a universal constant. The point is that schematically, if you have a geodesic here and its length is smaller than the n-dimensional Margulis constant. So there's a positive constant in dimension n, then it's possible to expand this normal bundle so large that on the boundary the injectivity radius is bigger than the Margulis constant everywhere. So here, and there's some constant for a surface, it's at least as big as 1 over 10, and you're guaranteed that when you have a short geodesic on the surface, you can expand this normal bundle until the boundary is length at least 1/10. And a kind of similar statement holds in any dimension. So this has a consequence, and the consequence is that the thin parts are standard. So let me say what that means. So you have a hyperbolic manifold, and you fix a constant, a positive constant epsilon, and you look at the thin part of the manifold. That's the part where the injectivity radius is smaller than epsilon. That means that there's a geodesic based at that point of length at most 2 epsilon. It means that if you stand at a point and you inflate a balloon, by the time the balloon is radius epsilon, the balloon has bumped into itself. Thin parts are standard is a consequence of this. So what that means is if you take, there's this universal constant, the Margulis constant, and if you look at the part of your n-dimensional manifold which is thin, that means that the injectivity radius is less than this universal constant, mu n, then the topology of those pieces is standard. In particular, if you're working in a closed hyperbolic 3-manifold, an orientable one, it means that every closed geodesic of length less than mu n has this, the thin part it sits in is standard, it's a solid torus. It also applies to manifolds with cusps, and it tells you that cusps in any dimension are some kind of standard object. And this Margulis, the basic idea here is that one is dealing with a discrete group of isometries. We're dealing with a discrete group, well, in isometries of hyperbolic n-space. And the basic point is that if you take the commutator of two things close to the identity, then you end up even closer to the identity. So in a discrete group, you can only, you know, a group is discrete means that there are no things very close to the identity. When you have a short geodesic, well, basically, a short geodesic leads to an element in the group which is close to the identity. And if this kind of neighbourhood were to bump into itself before it got very big, you'd have a pair of non-commuting matrices very close to the identity. And then when you took their commutator, it would be closer to the identity still, but not the identity. And that would violate the fact you've got a discrete group. So the kind of the thin parts of a hyperbolic manifold are standard. So in particular, in dimension 3, one has tubes, meaning a solid torus, topologically, the product of a circle and a disk, when you have a short closed geodesic. And one also has cusps that Dave talked about last time, and I will be talking a bit more about, again, you have topologically you have a torus times a half infinite interval, and metrically the torus direction is shrinking exponentially as you go out into the cusp. So I'll have a bit more to say about that. So to kind of approach this Thurston picture a bit more, one needs a notion of, I have to talk about the Gromov-Hausdorff topology. So one wants to think about 3-manifolds with hyperbolic metrics on, and not necessarily a fixed topological type. One would like to say what it means for a sequence of hyperbolic 3-manifolds where both the topology and the geometry are changing, to converge to some limiting hyperbolic three-manifold of different topology. So this kind of situation here. And it's a very kind of geometric notion, Gromov-Hausdorff convergence. I mean, roughly speaking, what it means is if you, the observer, stand at the base point on this sequence, and you have a sequence of metric spaces, and you're kind of standing at the base point, and you look around you, as you look over bigger and bigger distances, the geometry converges as you go further and further out in the sequence. So that, I mean, if you sit, you stand here and you watch this sequence of metric spaces, they apparently, on bigger and bigger sets, they're getting closer and closer to this one. And so that actually, that makes sense in a very, very general setting. I'm just going to spend a few moments explaining the Gromov-Hausdorff topology. So we're kind of interested in this in the case of metrics on three-dimensional manifolds. But as I say, it's very general, and it's actually the simplest version applies to not just manifolds, but any kind of metric space, any metric space. And the simplest version is when you have metric spaces satisfying a technical condition that I will describe. So it's all metric spaces, I should say all complete metric spaces. So every Cauchy sequence converges, or to put it another way, you can't go to infinity travelling a finite distance. You can't fall out of the metric space. All complete metric spaces, which are uniformly totally bounded. I always have to stop myself saying uniformly totally bounded, man. To be in California. Uniformly totally bounded. So what does this mean? If you have a metric space, a compact metric space, you can take an epsilon net in it. So you just take, you've got some metric space, and you pick some points in it, a discrete set of points, so that everything is within epsilon of one of these points. And we're going to deal here with compact metric spaces initially. And so if you fix an epsilon, it's a compact metric space, so you can find a finite number of points with the property that every point in the metric space is within distance epsilon of at least one of these. And the basic idea behind the whole approach is that, up to a small amount of error, you can approximate this metric space by an epsilon net, provided you choose epsilon to be very small. And, of course, when you're dealing with a finite approximation, it doesn't really matter whether the underlying space is a five-dimensional manifold, a seven-dimensional manifold, or not a manifold at all, because you're dealing with finitely many points together with the distances between them. So uniformly totally bounded means one deals with a collection of metric spaces where you can use an epsilon net with at most n points, the same number of points in every metric space. So you can kind of uniformly approximate to within a distance epsilon all the metric spaces in the family you're looking at. So that's the condition. It's somehow preventing too much local complexity.
For every epsilon, there exists an n?
So the statement is that, it's uniformly, this is a definition from metric space theory, what it means for metric space to be totally bounded. And so this means that for all epsilon, there exists an n. So that there exists, for all metric spaces x in the set, there exists an epsilon net for x with less than or equal to n points in that epsilon net. And then the theorem is that there's a kind of obvious notion there of convergence in this set. right? I mean, so if you've got a sequence of metric spaces in S, you can pick an epsilon, and you can approximate all the metric spaces in your sequence by endpoints. And the distances, the pairwise distances between those points, are bounded above by at most the number of points times epsilon. So you've got these, this bounded number of points. The only thing that's important is the distances between them. And the distances can't get very big, so you can always subconverge. And so if you have a sequence of metric spaces up to a given error, epsilon, you can find a subsequence that converges. And so the theorem is that S is compact. So in particular, if one was working, for example, with if you're working in the, what's called the bounded geometry case, if you're working in a fixed dimension n, you're looking at manifolds whose diameter is bounded above, whose injectivity radius is bounded below, whose curvatures are bounded, two-sided bounds, that fits into one of these sets. And then whenever you have a sequence of such manifolds, you can get extract some kind of limit, which may not actually be a manifold, but at least it's some kind of metric space. Well, so the theory works very well in the uniformly totally bounded setting, but this implies in particular that the metric spaces are compact. And I should say, another point here is that limits are unique. So this gives rise to a notion, it kind of formalizes this idea, stand at a base point, look what's happening around you, except in the compact case you don't have to pick a base point. And so the point is that if you have a sequence of metric spaces that converges in this notion, the limit is unique. So the kind of thing that this looks at, for example, if you take a circle and you scale it by epsilon and you take the product with another circle, then as epsilon goes to zero, so this is a sequence of Euclidean tori, and one of the circles and one of the tori is shrinking, and so we've got these metric spaces that are becoming very, very skinny tori. And with this notion of Gromov-Hausdorff limit, the limiting metric space is a circle. So this is a case where one has dimension collapse. We want to do this, though, in the non-compact case. And so there's a modification here. So we want to generalize this notion to the case of non-compact metric spaces. And the idea is, if you have a non-compact metric space, well, you have to introduce a base point. So you use a base point, and then so you've got this sequence of metric spaces of infinite diameter, and in each one you've got a base point, and you want a notion of convergence. Well, you restrict attention initially to the ball of radius 1 around the base point, and then you're in this setting, and there's some convergent subsequence where the balls of radius 1 converge. And then you go to pass to a bigger ball, and you take the balls of radius 2 around the base point and get a subsequence there that converges, and so on. And so one, the kind of theory works out the same way here. The only point is that the limit depends on the base point. So there's this kind of general notion of convergence of metric spaces. Okay, now I want to talk a little bit about hyperbolic manifolds in dimension 3 and more. And I want to talk, I'm going to talk about both about rigidity and flexibility. So this is hyperbolic manifolds in dimension bigger than or equal to 3. So there's a fundamental difference between dimension 2 and dimension 3 or more. And this is the Mostert-Prasad rigidity theorem, which they've talked about. And what this says is that if M is hyperbolic, the dimension is at least 3, the volume of M is finite, and M is complete as a metric space. So if M is compact, this condition is automatic. Complete means that a geodesic can be extended indefinitely. It's geodesically complete. It means Cauchy sequences converge. So if M is complete, then the hyperbolic structure, so we're assuming the manifold is hyperbolic, then the hyperbolic structure is unique. There are no moduli. And in so this is true in dimension 3 or more. In dimension 2, of course, it's not true. I showed you the moduli for surfaces. So in dimension 3 or more, hyperbolic structure, the complete one, if it exists, is unique. Let me just discuss this condition about finite volume. So one of the things one can do is, if you have a hyperbolic surface, well, a hyperbolic surface you can think of as, you start where it's the quotient of the hyperbolic plane of hyperbolic two-dimensional space by a group of isometries. So if you have a surface, you can think of it, that surface, as there is a discrete group of hyperbolic isometries acting on the hyperbolic plane, and the quotient is a hyperbolic surface. But now you can think of the hyperbolic plane, so this is a picture of the hyperbolic plane, as sitting in hyperbolic 3 space. So these isometries of the hyperbolic plane extend over hyperbolic 3 space, and if you take the quotient of hyperbolic 3 space by this group, you get a hyperbolic 3 manifold M. And it's what's called, well, it's topologically, it's not very exciting. It's topologically, it's surface cross R. And geometrically, it's a bit more interesting. In the middle of the F cross R, you have F times 0. This is a quotient of the original hyperbolic plane by the group. But as you go out in this direction, topologically you have other surfaces, but they're expanding, they're getting exponentially big. They're not geodesic, these are just kind of equidistant surfaces, they're not flat surfaces. So the point is that if you quotient out hyperbolic 3 space, if you think of every hyperbolic surface gives you a hyperbolic 3 manifold of infinite volume. But now there's something you can do. There are more deformations here than just the two-dimensional deformations. There's something called bending. So I kind of showed you the kind of deformations of a hyperbolic surface, but you can exploit the third dimension, and the picture kind of I'm about to draw shows you how you might do that. So I'm going to take a genus 2 surface, and I'm kind of, it starts out being a hyperbolic surface, and then I'm going to bend it along this geodesic. And so here I've got this surface. This surface the universal cover of this surface is the hyperbolic plane, sorry. And you have all these geodesics here. And now the idea is to take this hyperbolic plane and along every one of these geodesics to bend it upwards by the same angle. And if you so you'd think if you do that, I mean, there are infinitely many geodesics here and they're all nested. And so kind of as you travel outwards to the boundary, you're going to cross infinitely many points where you bend. And you might think naively that if you do that and you start bending by the same angle everywhere, the thing's going to crash through itself. Well, that would happen in Euclidean space if you try and do this in Euclidean space. But in hyperbolic space, it doesn't happen. If these angles are small enough, you can bend upwards this plane by a small angle, the same small angle along each curve. And because it's the same small angle, it's a symmetrical bent surface. And because it's symmetrical, there's a group of isometries of hyperbolic space acting now, which you can think of as gamma bent. You've kind of taken some of these elements in gamma, the original group, and you've kind of moved them a bit to preserve the bent surface. And this produces something called a quasi-Fuchsian three-manifold. So, again, it's not very exciting topologically. It's still topologically the same kind of picture. But geometrically, what's going on in the middle is a bit more interesting. And you can do a dimension count here, and you kind of, the quasi-Fuchsian surfaces, well, they're parameterized. You've got twice as many parameters as you had before. You've got the Euler characteristic of the surface like before, but this time, the dimension of the Lie group is the dimension of isometries of hyperbolic 3 space. It's the SL2C. This is 6. So one has twice as many parameters as before. So you take a two-dimensional hyperbolic surface, you can deform it as a hyperbolic 3-manifold, and you've got twice as many choices. So there are lots of moduli in the case where the volume is infinite. For a general 3-manifold, if you have a compact 3-manifold with boundary, the boundary is surfaces, maybe you've got tori, maybe you've got higher genus surfaces. If the boundary of a compact 3-manifold has got some higher genus surfaces, then you can play this kind of game on those boundary components. So a compact manifold with higher genus boundary usually has a complete hyperbolic metric on it, infinite volume, and this time there are moduli, and the moduli are basically the moduli of these quasi-Fuchsian ends. Okay, now I want to talk about a different kind of deformation through incomplete structures, and this is going quite quickly. I might finish. So what I mentioned earlier was this kind of Thurston picture that you can change the topological type of three manifolds by a process called hyperbolic Dehn surgery. And so three manifolds are no longer just isolated objects, but somehow they fit in some kind of continuum. And so the kind of next topic I want to talk about is hyperbolic Dehn surgery, or Dehn filling, actually might be a better term.
How difficult is it to prove this statement over here? I mean, you explain why the volume being finite was necessary.
Okay, so in the case of finite volume, how difficult is it to prove the...
It's not supposed to be obvious.
No, it's not obvious. No. There's a kind of non-proof that goes as follows. So you have a hyperbolic structure. In fact, you have two hyperbolic structures on the same manifold. So this gives rise to a map. You can think of that as giving a map from hyperbolic space to hyperbolic space that kind of conjugates one group to the other group. This map extends to the sphere at infinity. That map on the sphere at infinity is differentiable at some points. If you're lucky, that map on the sphere at infinity will be differentiable at the fixed point of a hyperbolic element, and then you can use the dynamics to kind of expand the differentiability properties, and you realize that the map is actually conformal on the sphere at infinity, and then that conformal map on the sphere at infinity tells you that you can change the map on the interior to be an isometry. And that's kind of how Mostov's proof goes, except you can't really assume there's this point of differentiability that's on the end of a... If that made any sense. The real proof's a bit more complicated.
Don't you just say depend on the dimension?
No, yes, it doesn't work in dimension 2, and so, yes.
can I take the quasi-Fuchsian case as the
concrete
example?
Yes, so quasi-Fuchsian thing has infinite volume, and so there the structure isn't complete. Yeah, so there's lots of moduli there. Okay, so everybody's favourite hyperbolic manifold is a figure 8 knot complement. So you start off with the three sphere, and you remove a curve from it, and this one. So what you're left with is a three-dimensional manifold that I'm going to call M infinity. This is a figure eight knot, and I've drilled it out from the three sphere. And this is a hyperbolic manifold of finite volume, and it's very pleasing. It's a very pleasing description of this. One takes hyperbolic three space, and in hyperbolic three space, you take a certain polyhedron. This is a polyhedron whose vertices are on the sphere at infinity. It's a polyhedron that's made up of two ideal tetrahedra. So it's made up of two tetrahedra whose vertices are actually at infinity. They're not in hyperbolic space at all. So this is two, and they're symmetrical. These are two regular ideal tetrahedra. So So a quick aside, in hyperbolic geometry, a triangle is determined by the angles, and there is a unique triangle where the angles are zero, or more properly, the limiting angles are zero, and that triangle has its vertices have gone off to infinity, and then these angles, it doesn't look like it here, the angles have become zero. So the point is, there is a unique ideal hyperbolic triangle, and that corresponds to the fact there's a unique Möbius transformation taking any 3 points to any other 3 points, so they're all isometric. Well, in dimension, when you go up a dimension, it's no longer true that there is a unique three-dimensional tetrahedron in hyperbolic space. In fact, there's a parameter, a cross ratio. However, there is a unique regular one. The regular one has the property that all the faces of the regular one, the faces of these regular tetrahedra, meet at 60 degree angles, which is very convenient, 60 degrees. You take two of them, and then you pair the faces in a certain way. And I can never remember how you do that. But if you pair these faces in the correct way, you end up with this hyperbolic three manifold. So in particular, the volume of this hyperbolic three manifold is twice the volume of an ideal regular tetrahedron. That's slightly more than two. So that is the unique, complete hyperbolic structure on the figure eight knot. Now, the Mostert-Prusset rigidity theorem, yeah.
What does complete mean?
Complete means that every geodesic can be extended indefinitely. So it's geodesically complete. It also means complete is a metric space every Cauchy sequence. Yeah?
I think the
notice
of always have a capital rather than a red. The knot you drew.
Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear.
Alternate.
Yep. Okay. See how long it takes me to get it to alternate. Under, over. Yeah, that's okay. Thank you. The knot I drew before doesn't have a hyperbolic structure. It's one of the sad facts. I mean, almost every knot has a hyperbolic structure. Except the trefoil knot and a few more. And, okay, thank you. So the figure eight knot, and for that matter any other knot or cusped hyperbolic manifold, has other hyperbolic structures that are incomplete, and this is the wonderful thing. There are moduli, but it's for incomplete structures. So there are geodesics that escape to infinity in finite time, and so I'm going to describe that. So I want to describe incomplete structures. And again, it's better to back off to dimension two to start with. So I'm going to start off with the three punctured sphere. And on the three-punctured sphere, there's a unique, complete hyperbolic structure on the three-punctured sphere, which is obtained by taking two ideal triangles and gluing them together in the obvious way. So this is the unique, complete hyperbolic structure on a sphere with 3 points removed, the sphere minus 3 points. And one way to think of it is that, you take two ideal triangles and you glue the edges together. So I'm drawing an ideal triangle. A hyperbolic ideal triangle, by the way, has a unique, whatever it's called. I'm glad my high school teacher's not here. The point of the biggest circle in the middle you can draw. It's got a unique one of those. There's a unique point. Circumcentre?
Sounds good, circum.
What? In-centre. Unique in-centre. Okay, it's got a unique in-centre. So in particular, there's a unique, that determines unique points in the middle of each edge. And so that means there's a unique symmetrical way to glue these things together, where you glue the kind of marked points in each together. And if you do that, then you get the complete structure. But of course, there are other ways to glue the edges together. You can choose to slide each. I mean, when you glue one edge to another edge, you can slide. There's a parameter. Instead of gluing this edge to this edge by an isometry, so the pink point goes to the pink point, you can glue it somewhere else. There are three parameters here. And if you glue these two ideal triangles together by isometries along the edges, you get a hyperbolic surface. I mean, right, it's you glued hyperbolic surfaces together by isometries along edges, so you have a hyperbolic surface. And what is it? Well, this is the kind of surprising thing when you first see it. It's a sphere with... So this is supposed to be... You can't see it very well. This is a sphere, but with three holes in it. This is a sphere minus three disks, and the dotted lines are disks. And what's going on here is that there's a geodesic that escapes to infinity in finite time, and you can see it. So if you get this gluing right, you fire out a geodesic. Actually, you fire out a curve. It doesn't have to be a geodesic here, and it reappears. If you do the gluings right, it kind of reappears out here, and then it reappears out here, way out in the cusp, and it's shrinking exponentially fast. And because it's shrinking exponentially fast, that geodesic manages to escape off to infinity in finite time. So there are three parameters here for doing this gluing. There is one way, if you like a correct way, there's one way that gives you a complete structure. All the others give you incomplete structures. And the incomplete structure you get a hyperbolic surface which isn't compact. You can compactify that surface by putting the missing circles on the boundary in. So now you compactify. So here you compactify the... and the parameters, you discover you have three parameters. When you compactify, depending on how you did the sliding, these curves get a certain length. So this is an incomplete structure you can get by gluing together these two ideal triangles. Well, we're going to play the same game here. Because this is a geodesic, and this doesn't have any simple geodesics on it. Actually, those are not geodesics. This is a geodesic. So, in fact, if you can extend this to be a complete hyperbolic surface of infinite volume, and it kind of flares out when you do that, you get a discrete group, but it's actually infinite volume. Now, you can kind of do the same thing here. Instead of using the kind of obvious way of gluing these faces, which gives a complete structure, there turns out there's a one complex parameter. There are moduli here. There's a one complex parameter way of gluing these faces up. And you end up with hyperbolic structures on this manifold, but they're not complete. One of them is complete, but this one, and most of them aren't. And so one wants to look at what the completions are. And this is where the change of topological type comes in. And so now I'm going to talk about hyperbolic domain filling. Oh, I'm going to do one more example, actually, of incomplete structures before I do that in dimension two. So we need to kind of visualize this kind of process in one higher dimension. And so there's another thing one can do. So here I've changed the structure by changing the way I've glued the these ideal triangles together. But you could also change the ideal triangles themselves. So a different kind of deformation is, so if you take an ideal triangle, you could shrink it a bit, and it's no longer ideal. It's got some three angles in it. So if you take two copies of this triangle, so this time we've got three angles, theta 1, theta 2, theta 3. If you glue those together in the obvious way, you get a metric on the two sphere. It's a hyperbolic metric, except now there are some singularities. There are cone angles. So this is something called a hyperbolic cone metric. So what's gone on here is, as I say, we've changed the objects we're gluing together. We've kind of changed the geometry on the triangles. We've shrunk them. And here, one gets a kind of object with singularities. And typically, so this gives you a group of transformations of the hyperbolic plane, but typically it's not a discrete group. It is a discrete group if these angles are 2 pi divided by an integer. So some of these deformations give you two-dimensional hyperbolic orbifolds. Most of them are not discrete.
Different integers?
They can be different integers, yeah. And this is actually closer to what goes on in three dimensions. We're actually going to change the shapes of the tetrahedra we glue together. We're going to keep the vertices at infinity, but invoke this parameter that an ideal tetrahedron has. I mentioned this complex parameter. And when you do the gluings you did before, you get this kind, you get singularities, except in one dimension higher. And typically, what you get is a metric space, which is a hyperbolic manifold. Generically, it's got a single bad point in it, like we've got a bad point there. But for certain special values of the parameter, you kind of get spiraling in the third dimension. And instead of having a bad point, you get a bad geodesic, a short geodesic. But in fact, sometimes it's not even a bad geodesic, it's just an ordinary geodesic. And so, I'm getting ahead of myself, but the basic point is that you can deform the hyperbolic structure on something like the figure 8 knot or any hyperbolic knot, and there's this kind of complex parameter degree of deformations. Typically, they're not manifolds, but some of the nearby things are manifolds, and they have very short geodesics, and you've done something called Dain filling, and you've changed the topology, and that's what I need to describe next.
But then
this is actually close to an orbifold.
So that introduces some positive curvature, right?
Yeah, if you were to smooth this out, yes, it would.
It doesn't count that as a hyperbolic.
No. No, I mean, without doing the smoothing, this is a generalised hyperbolic object. If these are angles of this form, it's an orbifold. If not, it's a hyperbolic cone manifold. A hyperbolic guy with singularities. But if you smooth out, that goes away. So I need to describe Dane filling. So Dane filling, suppose you have a manifold M. So this is a three manifold, and the boundary of M is a torus. So schematically, here's M. An example might be, my favourite example maybe, is the figure 8 knot complement. Actually, that was non-compact. So to get a compact version, you remove an open neighbourhood of the figure 8 knot, an open tubular neighbourhood. And then you get a compact version of the figure 8 knot complement where you actually have this boundary torus. So here's a manifold. And now we're going to Dane fill it. So Dane fill it means you take a solid torus. And a solid torus also has boundary, a torus. And so now one glues the boundary. So you glue the boundaries together. So that's what Dane filling means. You take a manifold with a torus boundary component and you glue on a solid torus to it. And there's freedom in how you do this gluing. The freedom in how you do the gluing corresponds to an automorphism of the torus. It corresponds to an element of GL2Z. But in fact, it turns out that the only thing that's important for the topology of the result is where the boundary of the disk factor goes. So what the topology, when you glue this solid torus onto this manifold, the only thing that's relevant is the image, if we call this H, it's the image of the boundary of the disk. It's a simple closed curve over here. So this gluing is parameterized, it's determined by a simple closed curve on a torus. So there are many ways to do Dane filling. And so these Dane fillings, these correspond to a simple closed curve on a torus. And a simple closed curve on a torus goes around the torus some number of times in one direction and some number of times in the other direction. And so that's parameterized by a pair of integers. And in fact, it's actually parameterized by their ratio, a slope. So you can realize this by a geodesic, and then the slope of that geodesic is a rational number, or else it's infinity. So the possibilities for doing a Dane filling, there are lots of them, and you get to choose a rational number or infinity. And look at this invokes, I mean, you have to choose some coordinate system to measure slopes. The coordinate system involves choosing a pair of simple closed curves on the boundary of M, and then you think of one of those as the x direction and one the y direction, and then you can parameterize the slope of the Dane filling relative to those coordinates. Okay, so the basic point is that these deformations of incomplete structures correspond to hyperbolic Dane fillings. So here is a kind of picture of the figure 8 knot complement. So here's the cusp. This is the figure 8 knot complement, M infinity I called it. And it's got this cusp. So this cusp, metrically, well, topologically, it's just a torus times array, but it shrinks exponentially as you go outwards. It's like e to the power minus L. The diameter is like e to the power minus L when you're distance L from the kind of the thick part. So this is the kind of the topological part of the knot complement, so to speak, and then you've got this cusp going out. So one can now deform the structure. One can take an incomplete structure And the way you do this, you actually, instead of using ideal regular tetrahedra, use some other shape regular tetrahedra. The tetrahedra, each tetrahedron is parameterized by a complex number. For the figure 8 knot, there are two tetrahedra, so there are two complex numbers. In order to get an incomplete hyperbolic structure, those parameters Z and W must satisfy one algebraic equation in those two parameters Z and W, called the gluing equations. There is an extra equation, which is the requirement you get a complete structure. That's an extra condition. If you drop that, the moduli space then is given by the zero set of this polynomial in two variables, or however many you have. So it's some complex curve. Most of the points on that complex curve give you an incomplete structure, which when you complete it gives you the one point, gives you one singular point, a nasty singularity, a cone on a torus. But there are some other ones where the completion ends up adding a short geodesic, just like in the three-dimensional case I had on the board over there. So the picture kind of is the fat part of the manifold hardly changes at all. This is almost the same. But as you start going out, it's not quite the same. As you start going out in the cusp, I need to give myself space. As you start going out in the cusp, the change in the geometry kind of makes itself more and more felt. And at some point, the change in the geometry becomes complete and you get a short geodesic. And when you take the completion. And this manifold is actually a Dane filling. Topologically, it's a Dane filling. The kind of filling direction is dual to this geodesic. And so the theorem Thurston proved back in about 76, 77 is that, remember that there are infinitely many ways of doing this gluing depending on a choice of gluing parameter. And for all except finitely many of those gluings, there is a deformation of the incomplete structure where when you take the completion, you get that Dane filling. So this is Thurston's hyperbolic Dane surgery theorem. So the theorem is that all but finitely many Dane fillings on a cusp of a complete finite volume hyperbolic three-manifold are themselves hyperbolic and come from deformations. So for the figure 8 knot, I think the figure 8 knot, there are 10 surgeries which fail, and all the rest are hyperbolic. And not only that, this is where this picture I was mentioning of the kind of the collection of all hyperbolic 3-manifolds comes in. So there's a kind of, in some sense, there's a kind of continuum. And this continuum is, well, these are kind of hyperbolic manifolds with singularities. So here is the figure 8 knot. And most of the points in here, they're not hyperbolic manifolds, they've got singularities. But there's a sequence converging in here in the Gromov-Hausdorff topology. And these are Dane fillings of this manifold. As the if either P or Q goes to if either P or Q gets big, then the Dane fillings have hyperbolic structures on them, and they're very small deformations of the complete structure. So of course there are other knot complements in here, and they've got their things coming in. And in fact, this is a kind of very general picture. There's an old result from the 60s due to Licorice and Wallace, that every three-manifold, at least, so their theorem is that every compact orientable three-manifold is obtained by Dane filling not a knot, but a link. So a knot of several components. And with a bit of work, well, it's quite easy to show that that link can be chosen to have a complete hyperbolic structure on it. So all three manifolds are obtained by this process. If you start with some hyperbolic link in the three sphere, and then you do Dane filling on them, that's a topological statement. But then Thurston comes along and says, well, most of these Dane fillings actually are going to be hyperbolic, and you have this kind of parameter space picture of what's going on. Halfway through. I need to speed up. Okay, so this, by the way, is the... you often hear topologists say that most three manifolds are hyperbolic. And, I mean, one always says that with one's tongue in one's cheek. Nevertheless, it's true. And the basic point is that, you know, every three manifold is obtained by Dane filling, and most Dane fillings are hyperbolic, so there you are. Classification, the issue of classification of hyperbolic manifolds was raised, and so let me...
Want to say why your tongue was in your cheek? It sounded...
Well, I mean, to say most, I'm putting a measure on a countable set. When I say most, is somehow the problem. Nevertheless, you know, I'll wager you money. You know, you pick some link at random, you pick some numbers at random, we'll go to Snappy and type them in, and I'll win. So, even though I don't know what it means, every closed orientable three-manifold, every compact, sorry, I should have said every closed, every compact no boundary. So every closed orientable three-manifold is obtained by Dane filling on a link, a knot of several components. The classification, what does it mean to classify something in mathematics? Answer, it means that you can produce a complete list without repetition. So, for example, the prime numbers are classified. In the case of surfaces, the classification is conceptual. An orientable surface is a sphere with handles, a non-orientable surface is a projective plane or climb bottle with handles. In this sense, there is a classification of three manifolds, and you can see how it's going to go. The first thing you can do is you can list the links. You can write a computer program that just goes through drawing all the possible links with three or four crossings or whatever. It lists the links. That's easy to do. Once you've listed the links, you can list all the Dane fillings. So you've got computer program number one spitting out links one by one, probably with lots of repetition, but you don't care about that. To every component, you can then try all the Dane fillings. Those are just the integers infinity. So you start playing through those one by one. You then compute the hyperbolic structure, or show one doesn't exist. So Perelman claims to have proved that the Thurston geometrization theorem holds. So a three-manifold satisfying certain hypotheses has a complete finite volume hyperbolic structure. But that doesn't mean you can actually compute it. You know one exists, but maybe you can't compute it. However, Jason Manning in his thesis proved that in fact you can compute these things. So after you've listed them, you can compute their hyperbolic structures or prove that they don't exist. And then so now you've got this computer program spitting out hyperbolic manifolds, and then it's possible to check if one is comes out of your program, you can check if one is on the list you've got already got. So I've just told you how to classify, I've just shown you there is a classification of hyperbolic three manifolds. You set your computer running and it will produce them all with no repetition. So that's somehow not very exciting. And there are some subtleties here, actually. And one of the subtleties is, from the logical point of view, the data that comes out of this hyperbolic structure involves transcendental numbers in the form of solutions to polynomial equations. And so the question is, can you tell if a number is zero? And the answer is no. So there's a little bit of problem here from a logical point of view. It's a metric of constant sectional curvature minus one. And usually, although we don't say it, usually a person means that the metric is complete, it's geodesically complete. But it's often useful to consider ones that aren't.
Suppose I wanted them ordered by volume.
Well, if you wanted them ordered by volume, there are limit points. So if you list them by volume, you'll never get beyond the first limit point.
That's an evasion of the question.
If you want all... So you can also list by diameter. This is basically the Cheeger finiteness theorem. If you want to list them by volume... do I know what that means?
The smallest volume hyperbolic manifold is three manifolds. No, yes.
The smallest volume hyperbolic three manifold is suspected.
Is suspected,
but not known.
So you don't. So in particular, you don't have an algorithm for ordering them by volume.
We may have an algorithm, but whether it's been implemented in this case. So Dave Gabay and co-workers at Princeton have an algorithm which should give the answer. Or maybe they should have an algorithm which should give the answer. And the claim is that within 10 years we'll know the 500 manifolds of smallest volume, but at the moment we only guess. just over halfway. Okay.
Perfect.
There are manifolds of smallest volume. There may be more than one. There are finitely many. Yeah, and there is.
These limit points are from below.
So from the Margulis lemma, you can't have a very small hyperbolic manifold because that would mean you'd have lots of matrices close to the identity forming a discrete group, and they can't. And then, so that tells you the volume isn't bounded below, but it's easy to see as well. There have to be smallest ones that the lowest bounds attained.
We're going to force you to stop, probably.
Okay.
And then you and I can talk about it later.
Yeah.
Questions? So next week we might have more of this, or we might have something else. Check the website. Pardon? Well, I haven't confirmed with the speaker that he's willing. Did you press the off button?
No. I can press the erase button.